सोच विचार के साथ। मेरा नाम नदीम उल हक है।
और मेरा नाम अंजुम अल्ताफ है।
वेलकम टू सोच विचार। टुडे वी आर गोइंग टू डिस्कस अ वेरी इंटरेस्टिंग सब्जेक्ट, द वेल्थ ऑफ नेशंस। नो, आई डोंट हैव एडम स्मिथ हियर विद मी, बट आई डू हैव माय वेरी गुड फ्रेंड एंड वन ऑफ इंडियाज फाइनेस्ट इकोनॉमिस्ट, सुरजीत भल्ला। Surjit Bhalla has many achievements to his credit, and I won't take a long time describing them. But if you go to any search engine, you'll find a lot of writings by Surjit Bhalla. He writes regularly for the Economic Times of India. He has worked in the World Bank, has worked in many investment houses, has run his own hedge fund, and now Surjit Bhalla continues to write and do research in economics. He's written many books, and you'd be surprised. One of them is a very important book. In fact, he's written two books on cricket. He talks about cricket, doing hard statistical analysis, what I call the econometrics of cricket. But he's done some very good work on cricket, and people admire that. He's worked on the election sort of forecasting in India. He's been forecasting elections for a while and doing quite a good job of it. But his most definitive work is economics. He's worked on poverty, he's worked on agriculture, he's worked on many areas of economics. But let's leave that aside. Surjit Bhalla has a new book out now called The New Wealth of Nations, which I think is going to be a very, very interesting book. It's already been reviewed very nicely by many people, such as Lance Pritchard from Harvard. So let's get right into it and learn from Surjit what the new wealth of nations is. Okay, hi Surjit. Can you please describe to me what the new wealth of nations is, this new book that you've written? What are the new concepts here, and what do you think is the main idea that you're pushing?
Yeah, the major new idea that I'm pushing is that the wealth of nations is really about education. Now, as you know, the classic book by Adam Smith more than 200 years ago laid out the roadmap of why nations were wealthy. And if one looks at it and reads it, and one finds out that very obviously education is not a part of the wealth of nations. The Industrial Revolution had happened. Illiteracy was very high around the world. And so it is not a criticism of the great master. It is that the world has changed. And especially the developing world, which is post 1980, and in some countries post 1955, 1960, that their great growth and the convergence or the movement towards convergence with the developed countries' per capita income levels has a lot more to do with education and human capital, broadly defined, than anything else. So therefore, the new wealth of nations is just look at educational attainment, and you will find the answer.
But Bhalla, wouldn't you say that this is a subject that has been well investigated and talked about for a long, long time now? I think it began in roughly about the 70s, 80s, after Gary Becker's thesis, and lots of work has been done. The World Bank has been pushing education and saying that it is really knowledge that drives the world. But then I do remember somewhere in the 90s or 2000s, Lance Pritchard came out with this paper, "Where Has All That Education Gone?" And there was a disconnect between the education attainment and the growth outcomes of countries. How do you face that question?
Yeah, that was an excellent paper by Lang. And just to recount on the education, you said 70s and 80s. Mm-hmm. Actually, it was Gary Becker, who you know very well or knew very well, was your thesis advisor, who first came up, the first economist ever to come up with the idea that education actually determines income. Prior to that, the idea was that, your access to natural resources, contacts, and all the other things determine income and not education. Then, you're absolutely right, 70s and 80s began a whole host of studies and literally running into the thousands of education determining individuals' income, and they all calculated rates of return. And I think you and I also did that. Everybody did that. And absolutely valid. I will come to the important point of land purchase in a minute. And then what happened? Basically, as you know, that there have been a lot of attempts in recent years, led by Credit Suisse, led by economists like Piketty, et cetera, to say that financial wealth in the world is highly, highly unequal, as well as income. I'll talk about wealth. So they have claimed that, you know, the top 1% in the world controls more than 50% of the wealth. And this they have documented through very, very elaborate calculations. So what I do in this book, which is new, is I say, okay, what we've been taught whether by Gary Becker or by any other economist, that the wealth is nothing more than the present discounted value of the stream of income coming out of an asset. Education is an asset we all acquire, and that yields a stream of income. Mm-hmm. So what this book does is to estimate, after controlling for education quality, and this is where the point of land Pritchard will come in, that after incorporating quality differences in education, you find that the education wealth in the world is actually higher than the total financial wealth. Let's come to the very important point and Land Pritchard's paper on where has all the education gone. And, you know, he's absolutely right. And this is a problem that developing countries are facing, as well as developed countries, that is, that I get stamped with 12 years of education, but I actually haven't learned much in those 12 years. And you cannot compare the average or the typical person or the median person, let's take it, in India with 12 years of education with a median, education with the quality of education of an Indian versus that of Sri Lankan versus that of Bangladesh versus that of the developed countries. So we have a problem. That is, the education quality is very different in different countries. And as we know, it is education quality that determines your income level, not just the magnitude of education. And as you know, screening and, you know, lots of...
What you're saying is absolutely correct, and I agree with you, and I think this has been a fallout of the early education research.
And enthusiasm.
Yeah, and, so quality has been an issue and it has been faced. But now you say something very different. You said that the quantum of education wealth, let's put it, or the wealth of human capital, or the quantum of human capital in the world, adjusted for quality, is higher than the quantum of financial wealth, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Fair enough.
And let me just, on this quality, and let's see if my quality adjustments pass the smell test. And I'll ask you a question, whether in Pakistan or in India. A 12 years of education, it's worth how much or what ratio is a 12 years, what ratio is a Pakistani Indian 12 years of education income compared with the US? Just take a guess and
Let me get the question right. Are you asking for the rate of return on the education, 12-year education in India and Pakistan versus the US? Are you asking about the quality per se versus?
No, I'm asking something which is, marries the two.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying how much does the market value 12 years of education, somebody who's a worker with 12 years of education, and let's take the median, in India or Pakistan and the US. So obviously, we will all agree that the median education level in the US is of a higher quality than the median education level.
But I'll tell you what my estimate would be. I mean, I think 12 years in education, of education in Pakistan would not buy you more than about median rate of return of maybe 30,000-40,000 at best. Rupees a month, which is like, let's put it like $300 or $400 a month. And if that, I think it might be, let's say $300 a month. In the US, it would easily buy you about $3,000 or $4,000 a month.
Okay. what you get for India and Pakistan, and I'll tell you what I get for China as well, that the quality of it, quality adjusted education, the market yields to an American about three times to four times more income. So the quality of education in India is 1/4 the level in the US. And interestingly enough, the quality of education in China is close to half
than in the US.
So I think, you know, broadly, my, and this is a new field, if you will. I have, you know, it's exploratory. I have given one attempt at measuring the quality, but it does address the important point raised by Land as well as others as to, you know, the quality of education is not equal. As you know, in the U.S., and it becomes more and more difficult. The U.S. 12-year college degree from Mississippi State is much less than a college degree from University of Chicago.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You're right. The quality differential is very important. But I think I'd go even further. Apart from the quality differential, there's also a problem of education. In a sense, I mean, the return to education, in a sense, is not sort of impervious or unrelated to the environment in the country. For example, the business environment in the country, the political environment in the country. I think those things also count, or don't they?
Absolutely. So, you know, as you know, Nadeem, that the economists have puzzled over, investigated in depth differences in income. And all I'm saying is that, you know, and here, if I were to get a little bit into technicality, but let me do that.
Please do.
Things that when the first results came out, for the developed economies, mind you, like the U.S. And there's a classic paper which I cite by John House, which said, if you're so smart, why aren't you so rich? So the point being that the initial investigations into the determinants of income in the U.S., and as you know, the U.S. data allows you to control for everything practically, found out that only 10% of the income variation amongst individuals was explained by education.
Right.
So the whole revolution, the whole human capital revolution was based, if somebody is not knowledgeable about statistics and econometrics, on rather flimsy evidence.
Right.
But that points to the fact that income is a composite of your ability. Look, we know, okay, whether we look at cricket teams or anywhere else, we know that ability is a big factor, which is not that much related to education. And clearly there's a return to ability. So I'm not saying that, look, but as economists, we take a broad sweep of necessity because we can't identify everything. And as I gave the example of education, that if it was the case that, you know, Gary Becker would be a nobody. Thousands of books and research not have been written if we were all occupied with how much does education explain. Explains very little. It turns out, actually, in developing countries, education explains about 5 times to 6 times as much as West. So the ask, the explanation of education in developing countries is much, much higher than what you and I observe in graduate school. And that supports my thesis that education is a big transformative agent that explains why developing countries have grown faster and why they will continue to grow faster than the developed.
But Bala, look, think about this this way. If education is that big transformative force, right? World Bank has invested a ton of money in education in the last, 30, 40 years. And yet, even though the growth in some countries have picked up, I won't deny that. Certainly, like my country, Pakistan, growth has picked up. India growth has picked up. But still, the convergence rate is not as rapid as we would like it, A. And B, the inequality in the countries remain large. And those inequalities, even though you think you claim that they're coming down, but are they coming down rapidly enough for us to stop worrying? Or is the same thing as in the U.S. likely to happen, the Trump phenomenon, where everybody is going to be concerned about inequality and fight back?
Okay. Let us, what you raise are important points, but let us just be very, very careful here. Let's take the U.S. You know, by the time Trump arrived in the U.S., inequality in the U.S. was already at the highest levels ever. Okay. It's a moot question whether inequality in the U.S. will go up further or not. But absolutely the case that it is the highest levels ever recorded.
And at the same time, the education levels are also the highest ever recorded.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that is indeed one of the chapters in the book explains why... So wages in the U.S. are doomed to go nowhere in real terms. Okay, so indeed, it does have an answer to your question as to where has all the education gone in the U.S. But let me come to the Indian case, not the Indian case, but the developing country case. The world case. Look, you know, we both went to graduate schools in the U.S. We know that what is stated about the U.S. is generally considered to be what's happening in the rest of the world. The media dominates. The economists in the West dominate. I just mentioned as to how inequality in the U.S. had risen to the highest levels ever. Now let us look at the world inequality. And, you know, I explored this first. And imagine there's no country. That is, we take the world as a unit. You know, the world has 7.4 billion people. So why should we just look at 300 million people and their inequality? And it turns out that world inequality today is at the lowest levels since 1870.
Right.
The trend in world inequality has been going completely opposite to the trend in U.S. inequality. Now, if you go now look at individual countries, what you find out is that over the last 20 years, that inequality in the developing world within countries has either stayed the same or is marginally down or marginally up. Okay? And now let me take the regions. You have Latin America and Sub-Saharan Africa. Two regions with the highest inequality in the world 30 years ago. So those two regions, education has come up and inequality is going down. Okay? That's factual. So then we look at East Asia as well as South Asia. And in the aggregate, both of these regions have seen phenomenal growth and inequality either staying the same or going down. So we have England, where inequality has gone up, though now in England, inequality in 2016 is a lot lower, about 6 Gini points lower than inequality in England in 2008. I think a completely erroneous and false impression that inequality in the world is going up. And I'm afraid Piketty, by emphasizing what's happening in the U.S., has misled the world.
Okay.
Let me to believing that inequality around the world is going up.
Yeah. Okay. Let me take that up a little later. But first, explain to me, how do you calculate the educational wealth?
Okay. Very simple. Mm-hmm. I have, and this is the data by Barrow and Lee, where they have documented in a book called Education Matters, which came out in 2015. Mm-hmm. And without that book, my estimation would not have been possible. Mm-hmm. So they document how, by looking at school enrollments and school graduation, I think something like 91 or 108 countries, I forget the exact number, around the world from 1870 onwards.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I have, the Barrowley data gives me how much is the education attainment level, of the population.
Mm-hmm.
We also have various studies, and that's what you first started on, about rates of return to education.
Mm-hmm.
And broadly, we know that the rates of return to education, because of all the substantial research for primary and secondary schooling, is higher than college schooling. But, interesting enough, the rates of education don't vary much between 10 to 14% across levels of education.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Let's take 12% as the average return to education.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So now I have the schooling and the rates of return to education.
Okay.
I now take a step further and discuss just earlier as to what is the quality of education.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
The quality of education I take from the difference between PPP exchange rates and market exchange rates.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So in other words, the PPP exchange rate in India is about 3.5 times
the market rate.
Mm-hmm. The market rate, 3.5 times lower, as you know.
Right.
So therefore, the quality of education in India is, 1/4.
Yeah.
Let's say of the quality of education
in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. In the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Then it gets so. Now I've got, then you need to find out what the illiteracy, this is all for those people with some education, and we know in great parts there are still a reasonable fraction of people who are illiterate. Then I take the actual income of the fraction of people that are illiterate, the bottom percent or 5% as the case might be in each society or in each country and in each. And obviously, these are changing.
Mm-hmm.
And that becomes base income. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So, this is all going to be spelled out in an academic paper, which I should be finishing in about a couple of weeks.
Okay.
Essentially, the key points to note is that I take the valuation and incomes as observed in the market at PPP. Income levels. So I don't look at dollar income levels, except for when it comes to the quality of education, and that's where I adjust the quality of education by the PPP exchange rates related to the U.S. dollar exchange.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm.
And so I've got the income levels.
Mm-hmm.
I've got the average education levels, but more the income levels for education. And once I get the income level in any given year, what we know is then I the last bit over here is that I need to discount this income level. And I used in my calculations a very high discount rate of 7.5. This is how you discount the future stream of income. Now, 7.5 is really the discount, as you know. The discounted rate, the discount rate is equal to approximately the rate of return on capital. You know, nobody is getting 7% rate of return on capital. But I nevertheless use that just to, I made several assumptions along the line. And I want to make assumptions that are very conservative. So that they pass all the smell tests. So if you think, you know, so that's basically how I come. I said this will all be part of an academic paper, which will be available in, starting a couple of weeks from now.
Okay, so that's very interesting. So what you're doing is basically using the income levels of the country and using the education attainments and using the differential between the PPP and the market rate as the adjustment for quality, and using the lowest income denominator to use as a compounding variable, and then compound and calculate the discounted wealth of educational wealth of the country. And you come up with very interesting statistics, like US is about 81 trillion and China is about 57 trillion. So China is really catching up with the US. But India is still 7 trillion.
Yeah, and here's where you're...
So India is still that far behind China and the US? Explain that.
Let me explain. Well, easy to explain behind China.
Despite the fact that India and China's population is about the same, I take it that the US and China, the difference is the population effect. But India and China population roughly the same.
Yeah, and you know, well, let's do China and the US. The difference is because of population and the quality of education. So they have much higher. Remember, these are not per capita wealth. Yeah. This is national wealth.
So no, this is national. So I'm just using the population to understand. Yeah.
Quality of education differential brings it down. Otherwise, China would be a lot more than the US and so on and so forth. So in India's case, in 2015, and when the new data comes out, the last bit of data that we have on illiteracy and literacy in India is 2011-12. These things have been changing quite rapidly. So I, in 2011-12, illiteracy in India was something like 20% or 20%. Okay. And today it is close to, and remember, it's illiteracy of the entire working population. So therefore from ages 15 or ages 25 to 65. So there is a drag from the past. So clearly if the person is illiterate, even if that person is earning a lot more, attribute that to education, you attribute it to something else. What you will see, and this is again brought out in the paper in some forecasts going down the line for the next 5 years, that India does jump quite radically, but still much below China. But the difference is not 10 to 1. I think the difference is half to about 4 to 1.
So in India, you'll say going forward is going to accelerate its educational attainment and therefore catch up with the, well, not quite catch up quickly, but still catch up relatively fast with China. But this share of top 1% is India and China roughly equivalent. What is the share of top 1%?
The share of top 1%, this is whether you're looking at income or whether you're looking at education.
Okay.
Now, in terms of income, it's the usual thing. In terms of education, that's the other bit that is somewhat new. Though on education, you know, Vinod Thomas and all have done very, very good work of how to calculate for a discrete variable, the Gini. So from the, I get the shares of education, and from there I get how much, the, you know, the top 1% has. And what you will find is the top 1% right now in the US probably has, you know, 3 or 4% of the of the shares. But in developing countries, a lot more, and they'll rapidly go down. Because the twits or the top 1% can't get more than 16 years of education. Maybe 18, but not all of the top 1% goes ahead to get postgraduate degrees. One interesting statistic over here is that for the U.S., in a country both you and I know well, the average educational attainment of the adult population, adult meaning I think 24 and above, is somewhere between 13 and 14 and hasn't been moving very rapidly.
Right.
So there's convergence. Not everybody goes ahead and gets a PhD. And therefore, the education attainment levels has a ceiling at around 14. And that's what most countries will get to in 20, 30 years.
Yeah, but I mean, the second point that you make, Bhalla, which is very important, I mean, one is that, you've calculated this educational wealth, and which is very important. But the other important point that you make is that educational inequality has been decreasing over time. That in 1870, it was 91.3, and now it's roughly 32. So educational inequality across the world is decreasing. Right?
Yes.
And fair enough, one accepts that. But then you make the point also that education wealth is higher than financial wealth. Education wealth is something like $330 trillion for the world, and financial wealth is something like $280 trillion for the world.
256 versus
330. Okay. So now, 256 versus 330. Interpret that for me. What does that mean? I mean, I really find it hard to understand why should we compare the two, and what does it mean?
Look, one of the interesting things about you asked is why does it matter that education wealth is greater than financial wealth? One other part that I want to emphasize is that a large part of the financial wealth may and should also be allocated to education. After all, when you make income because of your education and you buy financial wealth, you buy bonds and you buy stocks, you buy housing, that came out from your education wealth. Okay? The income. That came out from the income that you got. Now, obviously, I'm not talking about Rockefellers and all the rest of it. So one is that it's an overestimate of the financial wealth. So what you want to consider really is financial wealth versus education wealth pure. So anyway, having with that caveat, let's just take with what I do have. The point I'm making in the book is that incomes are determined by education, and therefore wealth is determined by education. And therefore, if education wealth is declining in inequality, it's still high because of the quality differentials, world income distribution is inevitably going to decline. Inequality in the world is inevitably going to decline. So that's why it is important to look at it. Basically this is, and remember, the big reason why the world looks at it is the same story about unemployment and wages in the U.S. We're all prisoners of the past. And as you know, the big story in the U.S. is, unemployment rate is at the lowest historical rates, and wage growth is also at the lowest historical rates. How is that possible? And that's one chapter in my book, as you know. Goes into quite big detail. So it's education that's causing low inflation in the world, is what I argue, and not today, for the last 20 years. Now, the Indian RBI and maybe even the Pakistani Central Bank is not quite familiar with these notions. Hopefully, they will become familiar. But, that's the story.
But look, what you're saying is that education wealth is increasing, but more importantly, what it's saying is that education across the world is increasing because there's been a big push for education the last 4 or 5 decades. And therefore, yes, of course, the whole world is getting more and more education. There's no doubt about it. And quality adjusted still. That, you know, Africans are going to college. Pakistanis are going to college. Everybody's going to college. So, yes, that's happening. Agreed. And, yes, that's increasing the education wealth. But I think isn't that partly a numbers issue, that the fact that more people are getting education, so education wealth looks very high? If you go back, let's say, to as you start off 1870 or something.
No, no, one second. Sorry to interrupt. You raise an important point. Mm-hmm. You getting educated, mm-hmm. That has to translate into earnings.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. So therefore, if more and more people are educated and not earnings are not going up, mm-hmm. then the education wealth is not going up, like in the U.S. Hmm. The increase in education wealth hasn't gone up that much.
Fair enough. China has
gone up substantially because people are actually earning more.
Yeah, fair enough. So, yes, that's correct. But on the other side, what I would say is that if you look at the financial wealth too, financial wealth has also been increasing rapidly over the last, let's say, century or so. Right? Mm-hmm. You would agree with me that the financial wealth, I mean, I don't know what the calculations, you must have seen the calculations. Let's say, what is the financial wealth in 1870? And what's, or put it this way, what has been the growth of financial wealth versus the growth of education wealth over the last century? Any guesses on that or any ideas on that?
Actually, you know, I will look at it. That's a good point. Mm-hmm. I do have estimates for it. Mm-hmm. No, sorry. Mm-hmm. I have estimates for education wealth. We do not have the earliest, well, you raise a very important point that the the earliest estimate for financial wealth is 2001.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, but I think I will take up your, not your challenge.
Yeah, because I think, quite frankly, it seems to me that the financial wealth will also have been increasing over this period. And it's a differential that is being debated by Piketty, that financial wealth, in his view, I'm paraphrasing it, has been increasing at a much higher rate, and the rate of return to financial wealth has been increasing at a higher rate than the rate of return to education. Do you take that up at all?
No, I think that's, again, a good way to look at it. But how does Piketty square the fact that world income inequality is going down?
No, on the contrary, he argues the world income inequality is going up.
No. This is what is interesting. That he may imply that world inequality is going up. And indeed, he does imply that the world inequality is going up by concentrating on U.S. That's my whole point.
Yeah, but look,
U.S. is not the world.
No, but hang on. agreed. But let's.
That's why.
Let's face it.
As I said, income inequality in the U.S. is the highest levels ever.
Yeah,
but world inequality is at the lowest levels ever.
Okay, fair enough. Let's take that up a little.
My calculations on inequality are now even taken in, which I first came up in 2002, and now taken even by the critics, the Milanovic or the World Bank, or all of them now accept the notion that world income inequality has been declining.
Okay. Fair enough. I take your point. I've seen that too. World income inequality is going down. But at the same time, income inequality in the advanced countries, Europe, US, etc., appear to be going up, right? US specifically is driving this result.
This is, again, a substantive point you're making. It is not at all. I will look at, I do have the data, according to the Piketty income database, it's not clear that if you exclude the U.S., that Western Europe, advanced countries, that inequality has gone up. But I think that's a good, it's an easy calculation for
okay,
me to make.
Fair enough.
I think you're raising.
But let me bring another.
Nadeem, I appreciate it.
Another point that I need to bring in is, think about it, this famous book about the productivity or the technology slowdown in the West by Gordon, right? I think Gordon and other people, for example, Tyler Cohen, etc., make this point that maybe the the education thing has now been overdone in the West. That, for example, everybody, as you said, has attained 12 years of education or something, college education, or large number of people have attained college. Let's put it this way. Almost everybody's gone to high school. So the initial gains that had to be made to education in the early days of education, where you got from illiteracy to literacy, where you got from illiteracy to high school education and then to college education, that has largely been done. And so, in a sense, further gains from education now are hard to come by. So, yes, we've had this education thing, but the further gains are not coming in. And this is the point that Gordon, et cetera, make. How do you confront that?
Look.
Is there like a wall that we face when it comes to education that we can go to, let's say, college education and then there's no more?
No, look, this is, again, a substantive issue.
Is there a ceiling to educational wealth?
I don't think so. But what? No, I definitely don't think, because I think education is the determinant of income. What I think is the case in the U.S., which is what Gordon's book is about, and it's a very important book. He actually claims that there has been not much productivity increase in the last 30, 40 years. So that's a rather controversial and debatable point. I happen to not agree with Gordon's conclusions, though there is a part of, whether it's Gordon or elsewhere, and or other people, that I do discuss is that, and I think you may be hinting at that, and correctly hinting at that, that look, if education is increasing, which it has, education wealth is increasing, which it has, then everything is fine, hunky-dory. And what I point out in the book is that eventually, once education is complete, there's still quality of education differentials. But let us theoretically assume that quality is also the same. Then income distribution will be down to ability. And it may be the case that ability is less unequally distributed than the compounding effect of ability and education that we observe today. It's an open theoretical and empirical question. I'll conclude with the following. I think there are problems in the world, emerging problems in the world, which have to do with the fact that despite education, there is technology, there are robots, they're going to become more and more important. And, some fraction of the people, and this is where I argue that the world will have to approach a new concept of a wealthy state. And the old concept, okay, these are the poor, let me give them food stamps, will no longer suffice. And I think direct income transfers, as well as what is now called basic income, will be popular throughout the world and in some ways will be necessary.
Okay, so Bhalla, you seem to place a lot of faith in education.
Yes.
Education wealth has grown dramatically over the last century, and I think that's very believable, or maybe over the last two centuries as well, as is financial wealth. But I think you make a very important point that financial wealth itself is human-made, so therefore that financial wealth also has to be derived from education. So education wealth has increased dramatically, yes, of course. And I think your calculations are very interesting. It's a very good analysis and a very interesting point. But let's look forward a little. Let's stay with the backwards for a start. Education wealth has been increasing because the world has gone from literacy to university education and to PhDs and, to research, etc. So, yes, of course, education wealth has been increasing. At the same time, financial capital has been built. And now what you're saying is correct, that the developing countries will be acquiring education wealth. So yes, there's still some margin for education wealth to grow. But do you see that this education wealth will grow forever, or do we see that this education wealth is kind of going to be self-limiting at some point? When everybody's done a PhD, when everybody's a research scientist, then do we have any limits to education wealth, or is there a forever increasing returns to scale?
Well, important point here is that as far as the developed world is concerned, education has possibly reached its limit. In the developing world, however, which has 90% of the world's population, while some countries, the level of education has reached its limit, which really is that the average educational attainment of a person is somewhere around 13 to 14 years. The quality of education in the developing world has still got a long way to go before it approaches the quality levels in the developed world. So this next phase of the educational expansion that is taking place, as I said, in the developed world, not much more educational expansion. So they have, you know, marginal increase, but basically between 13 and 14 years, average years of education. The developing world, lots of room to go. Even after they achieve 13 to 14 years of education, the quality, which in many of the developing countries, as you know, including ours and yours, is basically quite low.
Okay.
So that next phase of expansion.
But then do you see this, Bhalla, which I see in my country, for example, and I've seen this in many developing countries, that one of the reasons that education attainments, as well as quality, remains low is the fact that these countries do not offer adequate employment opportunities. And most of the education or whatever, the skill training is being developed because of the ability to migrate. The incentives are migration-driven, not internal-driven. Right. So long as these countries remain strife-ridden and unable to sort out their own political future, will educational attainment catch up with the developing countries, or is education a secondary variable to getting your own political or or let's say opportunity house in order?
Yeah, you know. Let me give you what my forecast is. I completely agree with you that most developing countries and even some semi-developed countries like Russia, etc., have a lot of political problems, and they will continue. However, and maybe this is my DNA streak, I'm quite optimistic that with the increase in education, the political strife, etc., will go down. We've seen in a very different way, not political strife as much, but social constraints or with what's happening in Saudi Arabia, that with education, and especially the education of women, the demand for freedom has really escalated in a nonlinear manner. And the Saudi government is responding, possibly because they've got a youngster at the helm rather than somebody above 80 years or even 70 or even 60 years of age. So that's the first point. The second point, and this is very much related to your observation regarding jobs, that to what extent, and this is economists like you and me have to answer, and it's an important question, difficult question. To what extent is the demand for jobs a function of the supply of human capital? So you're right, these guys go out and are educated, are qualified, and don't get jobs. But if their quality of education were to improve, then clearly somebody in Eastern Europe or even Korea, you know, basically firms will then hire these people. So there are jobs in the world. There's absolutely no question that there are jobs in the world, and that we've seen throughout, even though we now have a definite constraint or definite possibility of jobs lost due to artificial intelligence, and that is an important consideration. But, you know, there's lots of work to be done. The problem, the people in India and Pakistan and the rest of the region are getting educated, overqualified, and with bad quality education. So the aspirations are much higher than their human capital. And there's frustration. There are social problems that result from it. And there's lack of jobs.
So, to some extent, what you're saying is that the market will equilibrate and the amount of education, the quality of education will be forthcoming that is desired by the market.
Always has
been. Yeah. But the point is this belief in market, which I also share with you, but I must challenge you on that a little bit, because it seems to me that this is the kind of solution that we development economists in the World Bank and IMF, etc., have been perpetrating for the last 70 years, and we've done so many education programs, education this, education that, and we've talked about it. But quite frankly, looking at it from the point of the poor man, and I did a survey on this once, and the poor people are turning around and saying, hey, education doesn't deliver anything to me. I spent 10 years getting educated, and you guys promised me a rate of return, and I don't get it. Now we turn around and say, okay, it's the quality issue that's at work, right? But
yeah.
The problem is that the quality is not available. And two, even if the quality is available, like, for example, take a look at this. India turned out a ton of ITT graduates who were very well educated, high quality, etc. But India could not accommodate them. All of them had to go to the West. And they manned the Western positions for a long period of time, set up all these tech firms, etc. Now some of them come back, but even now I would say they don't come back. And quite frankly, the flow is one way only. I remember doing a paper on the brain drain. The flow remains one way. So is it the market or is it just the way the locals are organized?
Let's talk about brain drain. And I think you did some really, really, very important and pioneering work in this. I think it was back in the mid-80s, one of the earliest papers. So I have to both congratulate you and acknowledge your expertise. Now, Nadeem, and this is what you should turn your attention to. There is beginning to be a reverse brain drain for two reasons. One, that the developed economies, particularly the U.S., is turning, whether you want to call it protectionist or trying to protect the wages of its skilled people as well as semi-skilled people. So let's talk about college graduates. They are, you know, the brain drain, after all, doesn't threaten the guy in Walmart. It threatens the guy at Citibank or one of these tech firms or whatever. So that is, you know, so that is why there will be a brain drain, reverse brain drain. And second, and more importantly, that our region of the world is recognizing that we screwed up big time by our policies in terms of whether it is policies for firms or policies for expansion. Labor laws in India are so ancient, they're now beginning to go change. So that their incentives, our taxation is at very, very high rates, corporate taxation in particular. And now with the U.S. cutting its corporate tax rates to 20%, this is bound to have an effect. So I think, to answer your important questions, there are two elements at work. One, that recognition that the quality of education is terrible and needs vast improvement. And, you know, slowly this will happen, whether it's the market or the government recognizing the market, either way it's going to happen, is happening, or the individuals or the parents recognizing the quality of education. And second is the reverse brain drain with, you know, their labor force is not really expanding. Whereas our labor force, the human power, no longer manpower, is expanding and expanding in a quite vigorous fashion. Add to that, the labor force participation rate, very low of women in India and Pakistan, Bangladesh, not so bad. Rest of the world, women's labor force participation rate is fine. But in the Arab countries and Pakistan and India, it's quite low. That's going to change.
Yeah. Look, all I want to say is that policy and the nature of the state matters for the way you get education. One of the reasons that the US and UK led education, and I don't have to tell you this, but there's a lot of history that says it's the Protestant ethic or it's the freedom or whatever, the ability to let the market work, that everybody got education out there. But even in UK, it was not as rapid because a lot of the uneducated people left the UK to go to the US and to Australia. And then they gained education there. So I think...
sorry to interrupt, but it's an important point that you're making, and particularly in comparison with UK. As I point out in the book, one of the mysteries to me and to several economists, etc., is why did the US gain ascendancy over UK in the mid-19th century? That's what they gained. And that was a time period when UK was ruling the world, literally. And along comes this Johnny called the United States and takes over the mantle of the leading economic power in the world. The military power, etc., came much later. I'm talking about the mid-19th century. And the reason was precisely that for reasons that we can go into later, the U.S. really expanded the education. You know, after the U.S. is the land of Gary Becker, and they expanded the education in a huge way in the mid-19th century. And in U.K., I think the numbers I provide, which are from Barrow Lee, are something like 25%, 30% illiteracy in the U.K. in the mid-19th century. Hello? What's going on? I think it is. Government policies are ultimately responsible, especially for the classic public good called education. And that's where many countries have failed. And the sterling example is that of the U.S. And it's no wonder that the U.S., it's no surprise, rather, that the U.S. turned out to be preeminent for the next 150, 160 years.
But think about it, just to substantiate your hypothesis, just to take it forward, what you're saying. I think, isn't it because the UK remained a fairly stratified, hierarchical, class-ridden society all the way through the 19th century? Whereas the freewheeling U.S. cowboy, the whole thing, and the fact that the U.S. was so decentralized, the Washington didn't get to New Orleans or something, that freewheeling, independent nature of local communities in the U.S. fostered education because that's the only way you could survive. Whereas in the U.K. in those days, even if you got an education, chances of climbing up were not as great as in the in the U.K. as in the U.S.
Yeah. Absolutely not. It is, as I also discuss in the book, government policies are critical, and the social construct, which is also affected by the government policies. So in this case, the UK was class-ridden, feudal. Then it became less feudal and more industrialist.
So hold the thought, Surjit. What you've said is absolutely, I agree with you, but hold the thought. We've got two or three things here that we discussed. One is that policy matters. Two is that society matters. Three is that politics matters, right? Now, we'll come to that at the end, but let me ask you very quickly before that. You mentioned automation and robots, and we all know this is coming. So given that, and lots of people are doomsaying, the Luddites are coming out again, what's your prognosis for all this? Does this mean that I should... now worry about the fact that there'll be job loss and that there will be unemployment, and therefore people will lose the will to get education again because they'll say, hey, what am I going to do with it? I can't get a job anymore.
We're already seeing that now. So that is not in the future. That is very much present in the emerging markets, and particularly this part of the world. That is self-evident, fully evident today. I'm saying that the forces, of nature, forces of the market, if you will. And I have a chapter, the last chapter of the book is that you can't fool Mother Nature. I am responding to, or I am confident of, that Mother Nature, which drives self-interest and which also drives public interest and public policy, will reign supreme. And therefore, we are very much at the bottom of quality of education, of aspirations not meeting with reality. At least in India, I can speak with some confidence, and I believe it's the same in many parts of this part of the world. This is no longer a problem, mind you, in large parts of the world, which includes China or Korea, or, you know, even perhaps some of the other East Asian economies. The problem is really, Asia, which is Turkey, which is the Arab states, India, Pakistan, and that has a large, possibly even Iran. They have to open up more, and I think we're already seeing signs. So I think for our parts of the world...
But Surjit, even if we open up, if technology is going to drive jobs away, especially from the uneducated or the low educated or the low quality educated, then in a sense the incentive to education, the Beckerian thesis, the incentive to education will go down, and people will say, hey, what am I going to get this, you know, a high school education for if I'm not going to get a job? Or what am I going to get a BA for if I'm not going to get a job? So in that sense, the margin that these countries have for gaining more education may not be filled. And education wealth for people like countries like Pakistan may not go up.
Okay. Very, very important point, and something, you know, normally my DNA is usually plus-plus and still remains. But I do think that not only developing economies like ours, but also developed economies are facing this problem of technology, of advancement, lack of jobs for, let us say, the bottom 20-25% of the population who have been displaced, are being displaced. In the first instance, they get displaced by their own countrymen and countrywomen, and in the second round, they get displaced by people in the rest of the world who have higher human capital than they do.
Okay.
And this is where, you know, subtitle of my book might be Towards a New Welfare Order, where I talk about not necessarily universal basic income, but income transfers. Going back to, again, another...
Sorry, what is that? Income? Income, sorry, I didn't get that.
A negative income tax.
Okay.
Income transfers rather than, you know, how we handle poverty and income redistribution was through kind. I think the world is moving towards where we'll have to handle it through cash and income transfers for the bottom 20%, 30%, 40%. The second part why that will become necessary, think about the following. Let us say everybody in the world, okay, and that is not that far off. We're talking 30 years down the line when you and I won't be there, but I think the world will be there, that everybody has the same quality of education. Okay? As I said, the West is already there. Large parts of East Asia are going to be there, and even our parts of the world will be there. In that limiting case, okay? So this is the supply. I'm not talking about the demand. In this limiting case, income inequality will reflect ability. And there's good reason to think that ability is much more narrowly distributed than whether wealth, which what we talked about, or income.
Okay.
So we are entering into a world where there is a income inequality will inevitably go down.
Okay.
At the same time, that unless, you know, and technology is something that we've always recognized, but it's always been net employment creation. Mm-hmm. For the very first time, if you have a machine, mm-hmm. which does, machines can be replicated mm-hmm. At an instant much faster than babies can be born. Mm-hmm. This is a first-time experience for humankind.
Yeah.
And it's a, believe me, I it is going to be
a challenging experience.
Social challenge problem.
Yeah.
And, you know, the well-educated, the more able. Mm. Remember, we are now saying that abilities, everybody's got the same quality of education. Mm. What will differentiate people is their ability and, you know, there are bound to be some very smart people. We knew them in college and they're bound to be so not so smart people. That's just, you know, and whether they are the jobs to satisfy the bottom third or bottom quarter of the population is an unknown. And therefore, at a minimum, societies will have to transfer income. And it is not a surprise that, you know, there was a referendum held in Switzerland a year ago. It failed about universal basic income. I think that's just a starter. I wouldn't go for universal basic income. I don't buy the nature that, well, more able should get any transfers, but completely buy the thought that the bottom 25% should definitely receive. And I think, you know, we looked at the World Bank and the IMF and we thought of redistribution in very different way. It was always them food.
Now, you've raised a wholly different subject, and it's a very interesting subject. Maybe we'll discuss it some other time. But let me ask you one or two questions just to close. Looking forward, Surjit, and with all the things that you discuss, automation coming in, the quality of education, and the fact that without policy and without state and without society, education may not be fully developed, etc., etc. As I told you, hold that thought. Now, if you think about it for a minute, just reflect for me, what would you advise, let's say a government for Pakistan, Tanzania, or Nairobi, or Kenya, or whatever, what would you suggest their policy towards getting into the education wealth game being, given that they're lagging behind? How can they catch up with the West fast? How can they develop their education financial wealth to move forward?
Okay, I think that's a very important question. And for which it doesn't seem like the answer is that complicated. It means that these societies, these economies have to expand the quality of primary and secondary schooling. In that case, take for example, like India, you have these government schools which take care of most of the population, where teachers don't show up to work. There is a program afoot.
But Surjit, I have to stop you there, because think about it. This is something that I remember when I was studying economics, which is unfortunately so many decades away, I don't care to remember. This was exactly what the World Bank was saying then.
I know.
So if 50 years later we are repeating the same thing, we are kind of making us irrelevant.
No. I disagree. While it's been 30 years or so, even longer, when we were studying this and discussing this, well known. Now look at this, okay? Has China improved the quality of its education in primary and secondary schooling? Has Bangladesh improved the quality of its education in primary and secondary schooling? Has Thailand improved? Yes, yes, and yes.
Yes, but maybe there's some other variable that explains it. Right?
No, Nadeem, the problem is, you know, let's be very frank and honest, okay? The problem is South Asia.
Then maybe it's a culture. Maybe it's something else. That's what I'm saying. I'm saying we can't keep saying that improve it when we've notably failed in the last so many decades.
No. But Nadeem, be fair to the profession, be fair to the knowledge. Many other countries have taken this knowledge and adopted it and made it part of policy. just look at, did you ever think possible when you were a graduate student in the late 70s, early 80s, and when I was a graduate student a bit earlier than you, we never thought that China would have some of the best universities in the world.
Agreed. Agreed. But
so that is the solution is improve the quality of education, make teachers responsible, and if you will, for college, etc. In India, we're opening up the university sector to foreign universities. Technology now makes it very, very possible for you, for students here, without paying too much money, to get almost the same quality of education. Obviously, it's different, teachers not there, etc. But, you know, technology is going to make this possible. Otherwise, these guys are going to be dinosaurs. They are.
Fair enough. I agree with you. Look, let me give you very, very briefly what I think, and then you can react to that. My view is that in Pakistan, at least, what I observe, we've got a colonial state still hanging in place. We've got the same old thing that the Brits left. We never changed it. We've got the 1935 constitution that the Brits gave us. We got a 1857 bureaucracy that Lord Macaulay gave us. Our legal system was given to us by the Brits. That entire system is running for the colonial hierarchy, which people, the rich in Pakistan, have inherited, and they're running a colonial state. And there's deep, deep social divisions here. There is social mobility at a very, very sort of low rate. And the poor are condemned to go to these poor quality schools. That say whatever they do, they can't go forward. The rich have no incentive in increasing the quality of those schools. In fact, what the rich have done here is they have segmented the schooling system so that they have one system, the poor have another system. And the rich are investing only in the rich system. They're not investing in the poor system. Right? Take, for example, the famous Lums. Lums is a rich school. They invest there. They don't invest in Punjab University. So I think we've got this kind of a system too. We have to take that into account too before we say that, hey, improve this, improve. Because the rich, no matter how many World Bank loans, no matter what happens, they're not going to improve the other system unless the colonial system is dismantled. How would you react to that?
No, I think it's in the process of being dismantled. Okay. I can speak with knowledge and confidence about India.
Okay.
We've still got a long way to go. But I think the process has started. Okay. The recognition has started. Okay. For the first time, Indian universities are now getting much more autonomy. For the first time, we are allowing foreign universities to operate in India. For the first time, technology is making this expansion possible. Okay. For the first time, there's active talk about a voucher system for college and for primary and secondary schooling.
Okay.
This was unthinkable.
Okay.
The feudal, the corrupt, let's be very honest, the corrupt system. This is where corruption reigns supreme in colleges, in education. A lot of politicians run universities, but technical colleges, etc., where there's very little quality of education imparted because they are responding to the demand of the emerging middle class and the middle class for college education, precisely what we've been talking about in the last half hour. And they're exploiting it. And now the exploitation will go down because public policy and some politicians are recognizing that this has happened. And this has happened for the last 50 years. I mean, it is abominable that these politicians are running schools and technical institutes and even universities. I mean, I just think that. And there's full recognition. So in other words, it's discussed in the press, it's discussed openly. This is a problem.
Okay, good.
And
so that's going to happen. Now, let me ask you one or two last questions, Pallet. One question is, given all that's happening in terms of automation and computing, etc., how should the education system or the curriculum itself change? Because remember, when you and I got educated, and it's the same, roughly the same system that's continuing, we were focusing much more on content learning, and we were focusing much more on becoming databases. We were the databases, like you and I were databases for economics. There was a guy who acquired medical knowledge, legal knowledge, etc. Now, given that this shift is taking place, how should we change the education system, if at all?
Well, I think we have to change not the education system, but the learning, the learning system, or the learning coordinates, or the learning, whatever you want to call it. You know, in India, and in, I'm sure in Pakistan, a lot more emphasis has been, we all went through rote learning.
Yeah.
The U.S., one of the most remarkable things I found when I was an undergraduate there, is that the learning system was very different. It was no longer, it was not rote learning. I think now that recognition has dawned for the last 20, 30 years. Technology, you know, one of the things that they big ads in about learning apps, which try and teach you conceptually. It's a learning app. Nothing we should recognize.
Yeah.
There are learning apps commercially sold,
right?
Where conceptual teaching is the norm, not the rote learning. The idea that you can only learn from the teacher in a classroom and memorize mathematical table is gone. So the entire concept of what it is to learn is changing. It is changing the U.S. Western world. But in our parts of the world, where quality, not surprisingly, the quality of education
we are still sitting in the past.
And that's changing.
Okay,
so
good.
Let's recognize it's changing. It's terrible. You've been writing about it. I've been writing about it. We'll continue to write about it because it won't change that rapidly. Maybe it might in our parts of the world. But it is. I can, you know, vouch for the fact that the delta, the change is very solid, is happening, and nothing can stop.
Okay, final question. Can you recommend, I ask most of my guests this, can you recommend one book, one movie, whatever you like, for kids who are interested in learning, you know, whatever. Think about it, something that's moved you, that's kind of moved you to rethink the way you think or whatever. What would you recommend?
You know, I'll tell you from my own personal experience, and this is for college students, something, you know, high school maybe, a bit early. But the one book that changed my entire way of thinking, which I came to, unfortunately, quite late in my education and professional career, was A Road to Serfdom by Hayek, which was published in 1945. And I have yet to read a more profound forecast of how the world and economies and societies will evolve over the next 50, 60 years. I mean, it is, you know, I don't think there's any other book that comes even close to opening up, as a general book, to opening up one's eyes to the future and political economy. So that is, you know, I've always considered that to be my most moving in terms of, you know, and as you know, I mean, it will, to be able to forecast 50 years ahead, the whole development of socialism and the collapse then of communism, authoritarianism, you know, what a book.
It's a great choice. It's a wonderful choice. I agree entirely. But thank you, Bhalla. This has been an excellent conversation. I shall call on you now and again to try and, you know, keep this going.
Soch Bachar ke saath, mera naam Nadeem Ul Haq hai. Aur mera naam Anjum Altaf hai.